Hello and welcome to this edition of the Blackwell Online podcast. My name is George Miller, and my guest today is Ted Neild, whose new book, Incoming, looks at the global impact of cataclysmic events. Those events are meteorite impacts, but as the subtitle of the book makes clear, Ted believes we should stop worrying and learn to love the meteorite. We do, of course, come round to talking about the role a meteorite impact may have played in the demise of the dinosaurs, but when we met at the Geological Society in Piccadilly, we began by talking about the home of the meteorites, the region in the solar system between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter, known as the asteroid belt.
When the solar system formed out of the planetary nebula, the inner planets, which are all rocky like ours, between the very first planet, Mercury, Venus, the Earth, and Mars, they're all made out of silicates, the stuff that make up the rocks that we see around us mostly. And very little water, despite the fact that ours has got water, but our planet received water later on. Most of the planets, the rocky planets, are dry and have been dry for quite a long time. And the amount, this is because the inner planets are were formed relatively close to the sun, and for that reason all the volatiles were driven off. So you have these scorched rocky planets on them in the middle, and which condensed out of the nebula. And that process of accretion and condensation took millions and millions of years, and it gave rise to a curiously regular pattern of planets, which has one big flaw in it, and there is no rocky planet between Mars and Jupiter. And the reason for that is that Jupiter, being so huge, being the first of the gas giants, and bigger by far than all the other planets, it has a crucial role. It's had a crucial role in the evolution of our planet, really, because what Jupiter does is exert this enormous gravitational influence on that middle part of the solar system. And the first thing that it did was prevent the accretion of a planet in an orbit just inside of its own, because the gravitational stresses that it set up were enough to pull that planet apart. So nothing was able to form in the gap between Mars and Jupiter. It's quite a big gap. What there is an asteroid belt, which is just a collection of all this stuff that should have formed a planet, but never did. There are some very large ones, like the first one to be discovered, Ceres, and right down to very small ones, about the size of your hand, and well, even smaller than that. But it's a dusty, rubble-strewn area of the solar system.
It's an orphanage, I think you compare it to, don't you?
Well, yes, it is. It's a kind of an orphanage.
The homeless bits of potential planet.
Homeless
or planetesimals.
Yes, that's right. And that it's the material that it's primordial material, which is another thing that makes it particularly interesting for people doing planetary geology, because it's a sample of the material that went to form the planets, which subsequently, depending on how large they were, underwent lots of geological evolution, so that the samples you get at surface are now nothing like the original. And that's certainly the case with our own planet, which is very active. But this stuff is the stuff that made all the rocky planets in the first place. So it's a sample of the original nebula material. So it's very, very interesting from that point of view. It's the sort of material you can't get on Earth, unless it happens to land on Earth from the asteroid belt, because this is where meteorites come from. The idea that there was in the celestial mechanics that Newton and others dreamt of, there was never any room for grit in the clockwork, and for many years this set back the whole idea about meteoritics as a science, about taking seriously the reports that mostly peasants made of things dropping out of the sky, because people like Aristotle and also Newton and the combined the sort of gravitas, if you like, of the learned establishment said there can be no grit in the clockwork. It just cannot possibly happen. But of course, there is grit, and it's this, and it all comes from the asteroid belt.
And that the peasants, meanwhile, believed in all sorts of other things, you know, that you enumerate,
yes,
that could fall from the sky. So I suppose it wasn't such a ridiculous assumption that rocks falling from the sky was also the fancies of the ill-educated.
That's quite true. I mean, it was very difficult for a learned person to take the word of a peasant over that of Aristotle or the authority of a Newton. And as you say, peasants believe all kinds of other stuff too. all of which was not of of similar believability, veracity, whatever, as the dropping of stones out of the sky. But stones, of course, do drop out of the sky, and it wasn't really until two things happened. Well, until the Enlightenment happened, and until right at the end of the 18th century, some meteorites actually fell on top of professors. I mean, and that happened in Siena. And when eventually they couldn't deny it, because Siena was full of grand tourists, learned men from all over Europe happened to be there, and all the academy were out, because it happened in the early evening, and they all happened to be out there staring at the sky. And out of the northern sky, north of Siena, suddenly there was a meteorite which exploded and showered the whole place in meteorites, and then they couldn't deny it. The other thing is, of course, that the French Revolution happened, and that suddenly the peasants became citizens and they had to be taken seriously. And at that point, we noticed that there's a complete change in the way that the Academy treats the testimony of people who are eyewitnesses to these things. No longer is this just the superstitious peasantry talking rubbish. These are people who have to be listened to and whose testimony has to be taken seriously. And from that point on, the progress of meteoritics becomes almost exponential. And it happened at a time when a number of other sciences, of course, geology being one of them, suddenly became properly scientific in the way that we understand it today, and not were removed from the realms of grandiose speculation.
Take me back to the asteroid belt again, just for a moment, and tell me how the matter which forms a meteorite leaves the asteroid belt and comes to be on Earth. I loved your metaphor of the slipstream from this asteroid motorway. Tell me how the meteorite gets from the belt.
Well, yeah, it's all to do with Jupiter again, because for a while, when after people started to discover asteroids, and they started to come in pretty thick and fast after Ceres was discovered, more and more asteroids were mapped and their distances were estimated, and gradually it became evident that there wasn't just one asteroid belt. And incidentally, the asteroid belt is not the way it's portrayed in Star Wars. It's not this busy, violent place with things shooting all over the place and colliding all the time. Most asteroids are thousands and thousands of miles from the nearest asteroid, and you can't see one from the other. And all the space probes that you send through the asteroid belt to go out into the far solar system, they sail through it without any trouble. In fact, if you want to go to an asteroid, you really have to be very careful about how you aim your probe. What it does have is gaps, because it became clear that there were clear lanes within this. A bit like looking down on an old vinyl LP where you had a number of songs and clear black lanes in between them where the needle was conducted to the next song. So I'm explaining this for people who don't know what an LP looks like.
They do exist.
That's what the asteroid belt would look at if you could look at it from above the plane of the ecliptic.
And these are the Kirkwood gaps, aren't they? These bands between the tracks on the disk.
The reason they're there is because those are orbits. They define orbits which are resonant orbits, as they're known. So any asteroid which would happen to find itself in that area would find itself lining up with Jupiter more often than one that was out of phase with it. So any asteroid in that gap would tend to get pulled out from the gap because it feels the tug of Jupiter a little bit more often because it's resonant with it. And there are a number of these gaps. Some of them are strong resonances, some of them are weak resonances, so some of the gaps are broader than others. Now, because of the random motions that you find in any system like this, occasionally asteroids will wander because they're rather irregular objects. They tumble, their orbits are not quite as pure and simple as those of a more spherical object would be, and they have gravitational influences on each other. So occasionally one might wander into the Kirkwood gap, and when that happens, it is possible that by a gravitational influence due to Jupiter, instead of remaining in the plane of the orbit of the asteroid belt, the asteroid can get propelled out into an Earth-crossing orbit. So its orbit suddenly becomes elliptical, or much more elliptical and in a different sense, so that it passes out from the asteroid belt in towards the Sun and begins to orbit in a way that takes it past the trajectories of the inner planets. And those are the so-called near-Earth objects about which people have no doubt heard, with scare stories usually emanating from various sources, astronomical sources, where they say, oh, we've just discovered a new asteroid and it seems to be headed for Earth and we're all doomed. That's what happens. These are these very dark objects which are very difficult to spot against the black sky. And people have started looking for them since about 1980, when the whole possibility that the dinosaurs were wiped out by an asteroid came into acceptance. And so people have been looking for these things, trying to map them, to try and assess the probability that we might be hit by one of these things. It only makes sense to keep looking at the skies, keep watching the skies, as the 1950s films used to tell us. Of course, what always happens is they make one or two readings. It's not quite enough to compute a proper trajectory. And then after a couple of days, when they've had a few more observations, it turns out that the big scare was nothing of the kind. And it turns out that the thing is completely harmless. And in fact, that's happened 100% of all the times that they've spotted a new near-Earth object. So that's not a reason for not doing this work. But it does give you some feel for how afraid we ought to be of asteroids and near-Earth objects coming and wiping us all out.
I think you say the probability is 1 in 720,000, which puts it fairly far down the list of things we probably ought to lose sleep over.
The globalized risk of dying by asteroid is, or dying by meteorite impact is a complicated sort of calculation, because, I mean, for a start, being hit on the head by a small meteorite is known. People have been hit on the head by small meteorites.
There are some singed felt hats in the book, aren't there?
Singed felt hats, yes. There was a little boy playing football in Kenya, got hit by an asteroid that bounced off a banana leaf. There are plenty of examples like that. There is, of course, also the slightly mythical Nakla dog, who was supposed to have been vaporized by a meteorite hit, but that turns out probably to be a myth invented to gain publicity for a neighboring village. But no person has ever been killed, as far as we know. There's no documented example of anybody ever having been killed by a meteorite landing on them. On the other hand, a very large meteorite, something 10 kilometers across, if that were to hit, then a lot of people would die. So, and that's almost inevitable. So you have to balance the two different scales of things. But a globalized risk is now somewhere down about 700,000, which is on a level with a globalized risk for death by firework. Now, globalized risks, a bit difficult to get a handle on, but a globalized risk it meets the risk for any person on the planet. So you take the risk and you divide it by the number of people on the planet. So the risk of dying by airplane crash is something like 1 in 33,000 or something like that. But it applies equally to you and me, who might use airplanes quite frequently, as to a person who lives in the jungles in Borneo, for example. We all have the same globalized risk. So even if you're in the middle of Paris on the 14th of July, you might be more aware of the possibility of death by firework than you would otherwise be. But even so, people remain calm, and there is no reason why we should not continue to remain calm about meteorites and the danger of dying by them. There are many more things, more fruitful things that we can worry about. Nevertheless, we should still keep watching, because you never know. There might be one with our name on it, like there was one with the dinosaur's name on it.
Well, that brings me very neatly to my next question, because you describe how the theory that the dinosaurs were wiped out as a result of a meteorite strike as going from heresy to orthodoxy in the space of about 20 years. But your book shows that it is actually more complicated than that.
Yes, I think one of the messages that I wanted to get across in the book is that it's something that geologists tend to believe, and that is that nothing ever has a single cause in the history of the Earth. Geologists tend not to like single causes. They tend to prefer multiple causes. There have been five major mass extinctions in the history of life since the beginning of complex life about 570 million years ago. And of those five, only one, and that's despite intensive research over the last 30 years, only one has ever been tied in any way at all to a meteorite impact. And that's despite the fact that we now know of far more meteorite impacts that have occurred during that time. We know of many more craters which are being found, new ones are being found all the time. Not one of them is linked to any biotic event at all. There's only one, and that's the end of the end Cretaceous extinction. So something else must have caused the other mass extinctions. And there's no reason to assume that the Cretaceous one was any different. And they don't need always to have been caused by the same things. I mean, one of the things that I bring in into the book is a theory that was put forward by my old undergraduate professor, Derek Ager, who was a strong believer in this idea that the Earth is subject to multiple cycles, that there are many, many cycles that, that have an effect on life on Earth. They cycle from good to bad, good to bad, good to bad at different wavelengths. And that most of the time they're all completely out of phase. But that occasionally, just by blind chance, they are bound to come into phase together, and the concerted effect of all those things happening together would be enough to cause a mass extinction.
This is the silly diagram that you reproduce in the book.
Yes, Derek Ager's silly diagram, as he called it, yes, because it's a diagram without values or axes. But so he drew a lot of wiggly lines with different wavelengths, and just in the middle, there's all these things peak together. And that, he said, that's how you get mass extinctions. Now, if you look at the five big mass extinctions in the history of the Earth, the one thing that they're all correlated with is large igneous province eruptions, which are these massive outpourings of lava on a scale that our species has just not ever witnessed. There hasn't been one since our species has existed, and with any luck, there won't be one, because they are just stupendous. I mean, most of subcontinental India, a very large proportion of it, consists of of one of these large igneous provinces. And that was being erupted at the same time as the dinosaurs were dying out at the end of the Cretaceous. And of course, it was not just dinosaurs, it was lots of other things too, because it was a mass extinction. And every one of the five can be correlated with a large igneous province eruption. So they look, if you were looking for a common cause for all of these things, large igneous provinces are kind of number one. Major meteorite impacts are somewhere down the list. But we do know that one definitely happened at the end of the Cretaceous. So it was yet one other thing that made the end Cretaceous Earth a particularly nasty time to be around. It was one additional factor. It was the straw that broke T-Rex's back. It was the last thing which brought that period to an end. But of course, the end Cretaceous extinction was not the most severe. It was one of the most significant because it marks the distinction between the Mesozoic era and the recent era, which has got mammals and us in it. So we think of it as a particularly striking change, but it's by no means the most severe mass extinction of all. And the most severe one, which was the one at the end of the Permian period, no evidence whatever of any extraterrestrial involvement.
What are the big questions that we still have to answer about meteorites?
Oh, there are so many. Meteoriticists would say, I'm sure, that one of the things we need to do is to learn more about the little particles that make them up, these little spherules of silicate materials called chondrules, because the chondritic meteorites are the biggest class of all. And there are so many of them, they're so different, and they have a myriad of microscopic structure. And the thing is that if you're in space and you melt, the only thing you can do is form a blob. So there are all these high temperature events which happen in the formation of meteorites, and all meteorites have been worked and reworked and so on. Their chemical composition hasn't changed, but their physical composition has changed a lot. So we need to know more about what these little blobs are trying to tell us, because at the moment, very little is known about them, how they form, what they're telling us about the processes of formation of meteorites. They've also got things to tell us about the chemistry of the original solar nebula, and the original ideas about how the solar system evolved from the nebula, with a sort of dry interior with the volatiles driven off, which I described earlier, the volatiles driven off to the outer areas. That is now becoming blurred. People thought they understood that. Now we're starting to find things that are too far in and too wet to be as far in as they are. So obviously, our ideas about that are changing too as we find more and more meteorites. Meteoritics is undergoing the most amazing expansion at the moment, mainly because of all the finds that are being made now in areas like the Antarctic ice sheet, where people are able to find them partly because, well, they're kind of black objects landing on snow, so you can see them more easily. But that's the trivial thing. The thing is that they land on this surface. Nothing happens to them. They might get entrained in the glacier flow, but then they get concentrated in certain areas, and then the ice gets ablated, and they end up on the surface. And this has multiplied a hundredfold the number of specimens that there are. So who knows really what's waiting there? Because there are so many meteorites and so few people studying them, that there's going to be an enormous explosion of understanding stemming from these things. And it's got to do with the very origin of everything, the stuff that came before our planet. And but no matter what it is we learn from it, from them, nothing is going to take away that wonder that you have when you see a meteorite and you hold it and you know that is older. It's the oldest thing that you can possibly hold in your hand. There is no solid object older than a meteorite anywhere in the solar system. They are the oldest stuff there is.
Ted Neild. Incoming, Why We Should Stop Worrying and Learn to Love the Meteorite is out now in hardback. That's all for this edition of the Blackwell Online podcast, but you can find out more about the book and several million others by going to blackwell.co.uk. I hope you'll join me again soon for another programme, and until then, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.